Following in the weeks after Epiphany, I ask that the God of our friend Jesus may send us the spirit of wisdom and revelation. I pray that our eyes and ears and hearts may be enlightened in order that we may know the hope into which Jesus has called us. Amen. Please be seated. Sorry, my ear doesn't seem to appreciate this microphone. We had moved here in 1997 for my taking a position on the faculty at Cal Poly. We moved from our isolated park-like peninsula on Upper Chesapeake Bay. And coming to the West Coast, it meant I would have direct access to some of the most important emerging American architecture. Early in our residency here, we went on a day trip to Venice Beach, the home of some of the early eclectic work of Frank Gehry and many others. He had used the industrial vernacular of corrugated steel and rethinking of wood framing in the Spiller House, and metaphors of a former lifeguard tower and a new beachfront house for William and Lynn Norton. Our walk along the Venice Promenade that day is well known in our shared family history. The summer day was hot. The crowd was huge and pressing. We encountered the narrowing stretch where small stores and stalls are on the land side, and the sidewalk vendors line the beachside. Wave upon wave of a new popular culture of skin and leisure, piercings, tattoos, scooters, rollerblades, skateboards, and weightlifters was matched by the waves and wares of vendors in art, craft, music, and food. The colors, the fabrics, aroma of the food and marijuana, and sweat were overwhelming. As we grouped more tightly together within the crowd, we came upon an artist with a disability. He had no legs below his knee. He was on a small wheeled platform only inches from the ground. A set of wooden mallets in his hands for mobility allowed him to position himself as he whirled in circles, removing his works of outsider art from a small grassy knoll to be seen by viewers more closely. His long Rastafarian locks swinging with each move as if in a dance. I admired his work and dexterity. What my wife Anne remembers is our 8-year-old daughter reaching and gripping Anne's arm. In that crush and whirlwind of our new world, there was an appeal for assurance and help. 27 years later, we're proud of her career as a psychiatric social worker and case manager with veterans, ones the dominant culture has marginalized and cast aside. We hear again this morning from the Gospel of Mark. This pairing of miracles is in all three synoptic Gospels, but the usually cogent Mark gives us the most detailed rendition. In the vernacular, we may call this passage a twofer, or a flight of exquisite stories purposely paired with one another. Like the parables, that means a third meeting is implied between the stories. In the chapters before, Jesus has cast out demons, laid out the parables of the mustard seed and calmed the storms of the Sea of Galilee that were terrorizing the disciples. He had been gathering such large crowds that he left locations by boat. Even before he lands again, the crowds start to appear. In our social media age, we forget how word of mouth travels fast. First comes Jairus. And in scriptures, when we have a name, it may give us a hint to pay attention. The etymology of Jairus means to give light. As a leader of the synagogue approaching Jesus, it suggests Jesus is making his name felt in the Jewish faith into which he was born. Jairus, in proper respectful form, falls before Jesus, begs him for a laying on of hands for his daughter's healing as she is near death. Jesus moves with him toward his house. But before he gets there, through the crowd, a woman approaches who had also heard about Jesus. Unlike respectful Jairus, she's marginalized and has become defined by her condition, 12 years of a hemorrhage. We aren't told any more detail on that affliction, but we are told she has spent all of her money on doctors, perhaps well-meaning ones, and they have not helped, and they may actually have made her condition worse. By Old Testament Levitic law, she's permanently unclean. She's desperate. She makes her way from behind Jesus through the crowd and reaches, touching her hand on the hem of his cloak. Upon that touch, she felt in her body she was healed of the disease. Mark then gives us a fascinating insight into the fully man, fully God nature of Jesus. Immediately aware that power had gone forth from him, Jesus stops and looks at the crowd and said, "Who touched my clothes?" The disciples, like the so-called straight men in a comedy duo, immediately say, "How do we know? Look at the crowd." The woman then approaches Jesus again in fear and trembling, this time in front. Perhaps expecting an admonishment, she also falls before him and making no excuse, we are simply told she tells the truth. Jesus does not condemn her, but instead tenderly calls her daughter and tells her, "Go in peace." She's not only healed, she is made whole by his acknowledgement. Word reaches the crowd that Jairus' daughter has died. Some in the crowd say, "Do not trouble the teacher anymore," but they have no idea what is to come. Given that news, Jesus again speaks to heartbroken Jairus in what we could make our short catechism. "Do not fear, only believe." What is revealed next is only for the family and a handful of disciples. He leaves the crowd behind. At the house, people are weeping and wailing. Some commentators suggest that in the wealth of that era, paid professional mourners would come and weep and wail. And I take that to heart, because when Jesus says, "The child is only sleeping," they laughed at him. What could he do? But they have no idea what is to come. He puts them all outside, and with only the child's father and mother and three disciples, goes into where the child is. Taking the dead girl's hand, another form of Levitic uncleanliness. With this touch, he says, "Talitha cum," usually translated as, "Little girl, get up." But some trace the translation to be even more precious, "Little lamb, get up." And she does, walking around the room. Jesus tells them while they gaze in amazement, "Get her something to eat." I think that is the Jewish mother component of Jesus' life. There are many ways to see the third idea between these stories. Jesus is coming for Jew and Gentile alike? Yes. Women raised in equality with men as people? Yes. The leveling of grace for wealthy and poor? Yes. A preview of Jesus' own resurrection? Yes. Jesus conducting miracles as legitimacy of his status? Well, he only reveals the girl's resurrection to a select few and asks them to keep it a secret. It seems to me that between the stories are things we can learn about lamentation and hope. Unlike the professional weepers brought into Jairus' house, lamentations like David's in 2 Samuel for Saul and Jonathan, are the recognition of situation beyond one's own ability to cope. Weeping cleanses the eye to see clearly. St. Ephrem the Syrian says, "Through your tears and God's goodness, the soul which has been dead will be restored." What is helpful to me especially are the concepts of embodiment woven into the story, the physicality of the bodies, positions with each other and in locations, the sense of touch and feeling, the spoken words chosen for relation. Embodiment allows us to feel presence, God among us, and are appealing to the Spirit for hope beyond our expectations in this time. Being given the name of Jairus, yet not his daughter, suggests we also pay particular attention to his actions, about his bodily approach, frontal to Jesus, respectful, on behalf of a beloved. I think this is a metaphor for the embodiment of our church. We feel the realities within our community, and through the gifts of the Spirit, we are given grace and agency to act in hope. Those telling Jesus the girl has died, why waste the teacher's time? Or those laughing upon his arrival at her death with his talk of life, to me suggest a culture that says the faith community is wasting its time, as if it is too late to affect the outcome. The situation is hopeless to them, but they have no idea either. This stands in contrast to an understanding that lament and hope are bound in the process of being a Christian. Richard Rohr says, quote, "The human instinct is to block suffering and pain. This is especially true in the West, where we have been influenced by rationalism. As anyone who has experienced grief can attest, it isn't rational. We simply don't know what to do with our pain. The great wisdom traditions are teaching us that grief isn't something from which to run away. It's a liminal space, a time for transformation," unquote. Think of the embodiment in the approach of the bleeding woman. One can imagine her exertion, pushing through the crowd, metaphorically pushing all else in her life aside for an appeal. Her lament is captured in the reach for the hem from behind, just before Jesus passed on. I found myself there, and I know from the laments shared in this house, many of you have as well. That reach is grasping for a different reality. Be with me, heal me. And that opportunity is to be extended to everyone, as we are challenged in 2 Corinthians to excel in this generous undertaking. That sense of touch, literal and metaphorical, speaks to a certain intimacy of presence. That morning at Venice Beach, when confronted with unexpected ramping up anxiety, our daughter trusted our presence within the crowd. Her hand in Anne's was the connection she needed. Jairus's daughter is held by the hand and called Little Lamb. Jesus speaks to the woman as daughter. That is how close the Spirit is. Prayer is not a conjuring. It's a tearing away of what we accumulate that gets in the way of our being in the presence with God always. Theologian Jürgen Moltmann passed on earlier this month. As a German soldier, he survived the firebombing of Hamburg that killed 40,000 people. In his reflecting on the horrors of the war of his day, the saturation of death of that era, and his survival as a prisoner, when asked, "Where is God in this?" he answered, "God has chosen to be there, suffering alongside the oppressed." Daughter, lamb, give her something to eat, are spoken within a community that's intimate, bound together by love, not bounded by uncleanliness laws. Being with the Spirit alongside and each other, together in the now and what will come in hope.